Good morning.
Morning.
It's good to be here. I've been gone for a week. I've been on vacation, went out to the Black Hills, and it was great, but I really missed you guys, and I really miss being here. And it seems like a lot more than a week. So, if you know me, or if you've heard a few of my Dharma talks, you probably know that I have a lot of faith in Buddhist practice, that I have a lot of faith in meditation, a lot of faith in bringing mindfulness into our daily lives. And faith in the sense of I really believe in the benefits of this practice. I really believe it's beneficial. It's a wonderful thing to do. If it's the right thing for you, it's maybe not for everyone, but if it's your path, it can be a really wonderful path. And you probably know that the best way to make me happy is to do the practice and to show up at Zen Center. That's all I ask. That's all I need. And I've been encouraging people to do this practice for a long time now. And doing the practice myself and doing all the things that need to be done to make the practice possible, like building structures, like retreat containers and financial structures. And soon, hopefully, we'll have an actual structure, an actual expanded structure, an expanded building. And I do things like teaching youth group and sweeping the sidewalk and just whatever needs to be done. And again, I say to folks, you know, a regular meditation practice is really good. It can be really beneficial, even if it's only just 5 minutes a day. Please come here and do this practice. Hearing talks is one thing, that's great, but sitting down and bringing your full attention to your breath, really coming to the moment, or really paying attention when you're out there doing yard work or something like that, that's a whole other thing, and that's really wonderful. And I think I do this pretty gently. I say this pretty gently, but sometimes I feel like I'm not so gentle on the inside. On the outside, I'm saying, yeah, you should give this a try. You know, 5 minutes a day, just give it a try. And on the inside, I'm going, please, please do this practice. Because this practice is so great. And I am absolutely certain that it's going to be good for you. And I'm absolutely certain that it's going to be good for the people around you. So please do it. Please stick around. Please come see me again. Don't disappear on me. This stuff matters. So I probably won't say that in the one-on-one. I'll say 5 minutes, give it a try. But here in the big group, I think I can say that. So I think you could say I've got kind of this relentless urge to encourage people to do this practice. And it's not just me. Our guiding teacher, Tim, has that. All the priests here have that. A lot of others here have this too. But why is this? Where does this relentless urge come from? And well, I can't speak for the others here, but I can speak for myself, and that's the point of my talk today. Perhaps if I can tell you a little bit of where this urge came from with respect to me, it will be a little encouraging to your practice. I hope so. And this urge, I think, arose because of the transformative power of this practice. And why do I believe in the transformative power of this practice? From personal experience, from the way I myself have been transformed. Now, here at Zen Center, we often say, just do the practice and don't think about the results. And that is real good advice, because when you're sitting on the cushion, it's not helpful to think about some result you're looking for or how you would like to have things different. That's just not helpful because that takes you away from the moment. It takes you away from the task at hand. But it's also okay to realize and to recognize that the practice can have a transformative power. And these two things are not contradictory. When I'm doing the practice, I keep results out of my mind, but occasionally I step back and I think, okay, there is some power here. There are some things I would like to achieve. This is the way I might go about that. And then I let that go, and I come back to the here and the now. So this morning, I would like to tell you a story It's a story of what happened to really make me believe in this path. The story, I think, of the turning point of my spiritual life. And I've been thinking about giving this talk for a long time now. I've known it's coming. It's been for quite a few years that this has been percolating, actually. And I've told this story to some individuals when I thought it might be helpful. And it's in my book, Table 13 Journals. If I might put in a plug for my book, it's available out there on the porch or on Amazon for you people at home. It's there in the first few pages of the book. And at the reading we did here, I think Miles, my co-author, actually read my story about this. So some of you know about this and some of you don't. And it's highly personal, and it's a little uncomfortable to talk about, but I will share anything if I think it might do someone some good. And I think again and again in my Dharma talks, I try to go to those uncomfortable places because I find that they are so fertile. So the story begins with this sort of a debilitating fear that I used to have. And I had a number of fears, as many of us do, actually. But this particular fear really caught my attention because it interfered with my life. It prevented me from doing a lot of things that I wanted to do. And it limited me in my work. It caused me a lot of anxiety. I found myself kind of planning around my life around this thing that I couldn't do. And I was kind of living the life on the defensive. And that fear was the fear of public speaking. Believe it or not, it's true. It's almost like I couldn't do that to save my life. I could if I had to, but it was really, really tough. So when I was a child, I would talk to anyone about anything. I don't think I had any shyness, and I was in speech competitions and things like that. And junior high school went very well. High school was a little weird. I talked about that last November in my Veterans Day talk about the Vietnam War and my activism and how things got really weird in high school, and it was really tough. And that may have worn me down a bit. And this kind of shyness started coming over me. And when I started college, I realized more and more that I did not want to talk in class. And this is common. I think a lot of people can identify with this. I'm told that fear of public speaking is just one of the most common fears. Probably everybody feels it at one time or another. But it started to seem kind of risky to speak up because it seemed like it would be really easy to look bad. You know, you're in front of all these people, you say the wrong thing, and I just couldn't stand the idea of people sort of thinking I was doing badly or maybe of laughing at me. And I think this came out of that difficult high school experience, perhaps. But after I left college, there would be occasions when I really would need to talk to a group, like at a union meeting or something like that. And it just became really difficult. And I was afraid that if I spoke up, I would have this kind of a shaky voice. That was the scary thing, you know. And sometimes I would. I would speak up. And I was a little shaky, and I thought, oh, no, everybody in the room knows this, and they see this, you know, and they think there's something wrong with me, and there was something really kind of terrifying about that. And it kind of turned into this fear of fear, you know. And when you feel like that, you just want to avoid the situation. You might do anything to avoid that kind of situation, which is what I did for a long time. I would just avoid situations where I needed to do that. But then I went back to school after quite a long interlude, and I finished my undergraduate degree, and I started talking in class more, and I actually took a speech class, and I did okay. I made a lot of progress, and I decided to go to law school. And I remember my stepson taking me aside and saying, Ted, you sure you really want to do this? Is this a good idea? And I'm like, yeah, I can do this. I'm really good. I can do this. But he could see that it was kind of an odd choice. So you have to ask, why would a guy with a fear of public speaking decide to go to law school? Did I just not think it through? Well, I think what was going on is that I had these subconscious reasons that were a lot stronger than my conscious reasons. I think I wanted to go up against it. I think I wanted to challenge myself to the very core and see what was going to happen there. And maybe I had some hope that some kind of healing would take place. And all that stuff happened. So if you're afraid of heights, you climb a mountain. If you're afraid of spiders, you spend time with spiders. And after doing this thing, I felt like I had climbed a mountain filled with spiders. So law school was really hard. Now, I'm perfectly aware that I was really privileged to even get to go to law school, right? And there are a lot of people with much bigger problems than what I'm talking about today. And I've had bigger problems than what I'm talking about today, you know, loss of loved ones and that kind of stuff. So I'm aware of that. But still, this thing really caught my attention. It loomed really large in my life. So I started in the summer, and I have this contracts class. And I don't know if any of the attorneys, we have a number of attorneys here, they'll be able to relate to what I'm talking about. So I have contracts, and there are 99 people in my class in this big room. And this was a good law school, and these were really smart people. And the form of instruction is, it's the Socratic method, it's interactive. You engage in a colloquy with the instructor, and together you think through something, and the instructor may write some notes up on the board, and together you kind of build something in front of the class, this huge thing. And he may ask someone else something else to fill in a part here and kind of move around, but he always comes back to you. And you might be on the spot for like 45 minutes or so. And he'll come back to you the next day, too, for a little follow-up, and possibly the day after that. And there was so much reading to do, and I had my family there, and I wasn't getting enough sleep, and I tried to be ready every day, because you never know when your day is going to come, and it didn't come, and it didn't come, and the summer's wearing on, and I'm thinking, when is this going to come? And finally it came. My day came, and I got through it, but it did not go great. And it began to happen that this old fear would kind of come up, you know, and I need to perform in front of all of these folks. And the fear would just really interfere with my ability to do that. And somehow I got through that incredibly intense summer. And I skipped the last 3 days of contracts because I thought, I can get away with this. And I was so afraid he'd come back to me for some remedial work. So I just kind of slunk out of there, you know. And we had a few days off before the fall semester, and I took my family up to northern Michigan camping, and I couldn't enjoy it a bit. I was tense the whole time, did not enjoy a bit of it. And came back, started the fall semester, and just a few days into it, I decided, I just can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. It's just too risky. I feel like I'm not going to have a situation in class where I look that bad, and I was just going to withdraw from the situation. And I decided, that's it, I'm quitting school. And I called my parents, I told them I was quitting. I told my wife I was quitting school. This was not easy. I had dragged my family a third of the way across the country to this new situation and said, if I go to law school, it'll be really good for our family. It's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. I had taken out these huge loans, which, by the way, I just paid off about 6 months ago. And now I had no idea what would happen, right? I'm going to quit. We're living in married student housing. We're going to have to leave. I wonder how fast they'll kick us out. I'll bet pretty darn fast. And what am I going to do? I didn't even know. I thought, well, okay, we'll probably go back to Omaha, kind of go back into feet, pick up the pieces, get some kind of a job. This is going to be really miserable. And what followed was a period of about 3 days where I just felt about totally worthless, just totally worthless to my family and everyone else. And then, after about 3 days, something happened. And it started with some very direct, straight talk from my wife, which I think reminded me that this was not all about me. Because I was thinking about my family and stuff, but was I really? No, I was thinking about my own pain and my own fear, and I was pretty wrapped up in that. And she kind of snapped me out of that. Sometimes a little direct talk is really helpful. And I began to question whether fleeing this situation was the only way out. And I found this kind of impulse to find a way through, to survive this thing. Maybe I can do something. I don't know. And I've got all this turmoil, you know, and I've got this feeling of worthlessness. And this is building up. And then I get these turning words from my wife. And then on the third night, I think it was about 11 p.m., if I remember correctly. I went out behind our house in the woods. There was this big woods behind married student housing. And I sat in kind of a clearing on the side of a hill under the moon, and I went into some kind of meditation. And something very significant happened there. In a deep way, I really let go of the self. The first time I had ever done that in a really big, really significant way. And that's what it was. I took the self out of it. I think maybe something happened neurologically. Something certainly happened spiritually. Now, at that time, I didn't really have a formal spiritual practice. I had read quite a few books about Zen, and I had meditated on my own, and that had been really wonderful. I had spent quite a lot of time in the Black Hills, and I had attended some ceremonies, and at the time, mostly I identified with Native American spirituality. But what happened that night didn't seem to follow any specific kind of teaching. It came from inside. And I didn't give it any name. And I still don't. But this letting go occurred, and I stood up, and I was incredibly wide awake. I felt more wide awake than I had ever been in my life there in the middle of the night. And what could I do? Well, I needed to talk to somebody. So I called my brother. I called my brother Jim, because he's always there. Woke him up in the middle of the night. That's fine with him. He listened to me for an hour. He'd comment now and then, but I was working through this stuff. This was a brand new perspective. This was like, the self is taken out of it now. What happens now? What gets done? I don't know. So I talk it through with him. I'm working through as I talk, and he listens, and we talked, I think, for about a solid hour. And I came up with an idea, and I knew what to do. Because if you take the self out of it, you don't think about, am I going to look bad? Am I going to look good? Am I going to feel bad? Am I going to feel good? You just let all that go. There's just one question. What needs to be done? What needs to be done here? And believe it or not, I was able to get a little sleep. And the next morning, I went into the law school, and I found a friend. Sometimes in these situations, you just can't do it without a friend. And this was a woman who was a second-year law student and had taught me our beginning writing class. And she knew me, and she seemed really kind, and she seemed to know what was going on. And I said, well, what would you do? And she said she had a plan, which was pretty simple. It's the equivalent of going to the law school. It's going to the law school's equivalent of a guidance counselor. And I did that. And we talked things over. We worked some things out. Worked out a plan. She said I could go to each of my instructors, and I could just tell them, hey, talking in class has given me some difficulty right now. Could you give me a break? Maybe for 30 days, 60 days. I just don't call on me, okay? And after that, you can. All right? So I went to all of them. It was a little uncomfortable for both of us. but they all said, sure, they would do that. And I would have endured anything at this time in order to get out of this terrible place I had fallen into. I was kind of a desperate character. Desperate characters make great Zen students. And so I didn't get called on for a while, and after a while I did, and I managed to do okay. And that's because I would keep this thing in the front of my mind. This thing is going to happen. This thing that you fear so much is going to happen, and you're going to need to deal with it. And if you pay close enough attention, you know that you will be able to take the self out of it when the time comes. You can do that again. Because you've done that in a big way. And you'll be able to do what needs to be done. That's it. There's this thing you could do. And I did that, and I got through the semester. And I got through the rest of law school. And I was a bit strategic. I tried to kind of avoid situations where you had to talk in class a lot. You know, I would take certain classes. I would ask people, so do they call on you a lot in that class? Just wondering, you know. And they'd say yes, and I'd say, okay, that's off the list. There were a few times I did pretty well. But I always knew I could do it. And also after that night on the hill, I began a serious spiritual practice. If we walk through the woods behind the house, about a quarter mile, there's this place where someone had built a sweat lodge, and the frame was still there. And I would go there every Saturday with my son, who was about 6 or 7, and we'd go there, and we'd burn a little sage, and we would sit there quietly, and I would just spend some time kind of being with this thing that was continuing from that night on the hill, which is take the self out of it. It's so simple. And I would say, I am never in my life going to forget. There is this thing you can do. And then, in the spring, 1992, my wife suggested we go to the Buddha's birthday celebration at the Ann Arbor Zen Center, which was a Korean Zen center. And we did. And as I said, I had read about Buddhism. I had practiced on my own. But I had never practiced with other people, and I had never really known any Buddhists. And I walked in that house there. It was this big old house, really a lot like this one. And I walked into the Zendo, and there was this altar, and there was a Buddha there, and there were cushions and mats all around on the outside, which were brown, not black, because it's a Korean center. And I saw the very warm way that the place was decorated in the very spare way. And I saw that they sit facing the wall to eliminate all distractions, to just be with the thing, whatever the thing is. And I thought, this is it. I have arrived at home. This is where I should be. It's like, maybe that's what all of this was tending toward all of these years. All these questions, what should I do? You know, should I do this? Should I do construction work? Should I be a lawyer? And maybe it's all going here. So why would a guy who has a fear of public speaking choose to go to law school? Because he suspects deep down that it's going to help him to get to the place he needs to go, that he's going to find that place. And I practiced at that center for a year, and then I graduated from law school, and I got a job in the legal field, which involved research, not courtroom work, which worked out pretty well for me. And that's when I moved here, and I first showed up at this building on Buddha's birthday in the spring of 1993. And I had made some progress, of course, on speaking in front of groups, but there were still times when that would be really difficult for me. And I remember things like going to a parent's meeting because I was going to go on the school trip with a bunch of kids, and everybody in the room has to say something, and how difficult that was for me, and things like that. And sometimes at work I would have meetings, and if I knew that I was having a meeting on Monday morning, I would think about that all weekend, and I'd kind of prepare myself for it because I might have to speak up. Hard to believe now, it really is, but it was so difficult. I would spend the entire weekend preparing myself mentally for that. But meanwhile, there was this other thing going on. You know, I went to the Zen Center in Ann Arbor, and I started coming here regularly, taking the introductory course, doing meditation, doing retreats. There was a sitting group in Northfield where I lived that started up, which turned into a meditation center. And I put a lot of energy into those places. And after that first visit to the Zen Center in Ann Arbor, I never went very long at all without meditating. I had a serious practice. And in those places, I had a great sense of belonging and trust. And I realized that I could speak in those places, and I could speak as myself in those places. And if that turned out to be someone lacking in confidence, even if that turned out to be someone with kind of a shaky voice, I could do that because that's who I was. And these were very kind people. And it felt really good to be authentic about that. I don't have to pretend to be someone else. I don't have to pretend to be eloquent. I can be just who I am. Wow. And in a way, I think it's kind of a gift to your fellow practitioners to be authentic rather than withdrawing from them. And to say, I'm willing to participate and be who I am, even if that's not the ideal person that I would like to be. And you can be who you are too, and I'm not going to judge you. Because you see, I'm not judging myself either. Let's just be who we are. And I'd speak in little groups, and sometimes it was shaky, and often it was not shaky. And it was usually me speaking in a quiet voice, maybe sometimes kind of an open, kind of a vulnerable voice. And that was me being me. And then in Northfield, our group decided to bring in a speaker to speak to the public and see what would happen. And we got Shokin Weinkopf, who many of you know. And he came to speak. We had it at the Northfield Arts Guild, and to our surprise, about 50 people showed up. And it was my job to make the announcements at the end, and I did it, and it was adequate. And I even enjoyed it a little bit. And I remember I was talking about the location of our sitting group, and I said it was behind the place that used to be Ooh La La, which was the name of a store. And the way I said Ooh La La made everybody laugh. And I thought, okay, I don't know if they're laughing at me or with me, but I don't care, because I did this thing, I did the announcements, I did all right. And you know what? I think I can do this again. And that was the turning point in my public speaking career. I now had a little confidence, and I knew I could rise to the occasion, and I could be me. And I kept making announcements, and I began to make little talks to the group. And I knew that when the fear came in, I could deal with it in an authentic way, and it would take the form of genuine emotion. Genuine emotion, which maybe acknowledges the presence of the fear somehow, would even make the talk better. I was like free now. I didn't have to pretend to be anyone. And now, well, I do talks all the time, and they're adequate. And sometimes they're pretty good. And sometimes they're great. And I love them so much. There are times, maybe not so much today, because today this talk is so important. I've written it out pretty carefully, and there's not too much room for spontaneity, maybe a little bit. Sometimes I work from minimal notes, you know, and I have to choose the words as I go along, and I'm figuring these things out as I go, and I'm sort of building something, and you're building it with me. And you get to the point where there's just sort of the room and the presence of the mystery, and it's like I disappear and you disappear, you know, and it's just this thing, and it feels like complete freedom in a way. And isn't it strange? Isn't it strange? The very thing that scared me the most is this thing that can bring me the greatest happiness, you know? And it's like the fear is still here, you know? It's not completely, it's not like I pushed it away or moved on to it. It's like I'm friends with it. It's like, okay, it's, hey, fear, hello, old friend. Thank you. Thank you for helping me to transform my life. Come on in, have some tea. You know, you're not staying for dinner, right? You're not staying overnight. I'm glad to see you. You know, together we're kind of doing this thing. So I started speaking up at work more too, and I give presentations to like a room full of vice presidents. I gave a talk, I think it was about a year ago, to about 300 people, all of my coworkers, and it was a PowerPoint demonstration. I was up on the stage, and I had this little microphone, and I was kind of striding back and forth and pointing to all of this stuff. And I don't know what happened there. I was talking about the legal publishing industry, but I must have snuck a little Zen in there between the lines or something, because for about 3 days afterwards, people were like stopping me in the hallway and saying, wow, that was a great talk. How did you do that, you know? And it felt really good, really good. I think something just authentic was in that talk. So something big happened somewhere along the line. That thing that I couldn't do at all is one of the things I love to do the most. And I have to emphasize again that this didn't happen just as a result of one experience sitting on the hill. During this time, I was sitting and sitting and sitting, and I was sweeping the floor, and I was bringing the flowers for the altar, and I was talking to beginners about Zen, and I was doing retreats, and I was sitting and sitting some more. And I also have to emphasize that the thing I let go of was deeper than public speaking. And I think it had to let go, it had to do with letting go of a personal demon. And I have my theories about that, about what that was. It was about letting go of the self. And it's deeper than that. I mean, it's about letting go of conditioned existence. It's about that experience that is at the heart of Zen. And I simply cannot imagine going back to having that kind of panicky feeling that I once had. And I can't imagine going back to sort of the general level of anxiety I used to carry around. which I didn't even realize I was carrying around. I didn't realize how much it affected my life until I was able to kind of let go of it in a really big way. And it's pretty much gone now, you know. I get a little twinge now and then. I kind of see it. I go, oh, there's that little thing, you know. There it is. It's kind of arising. It kind of wants to turn into this big thing, but I'm not going to let it do that. I'm not going to let it do that because it's just, that's gone. That's gone. So I share all of this personal, uncomfortable stuff with you because I want you to know that the very thing that you fear the most can be your road to transformation. This was all about letting go of conditioned existence, but public speaking was the Dharma gate. And thinking back to that difficult time, I have to say that I am so very grateful for that crisis and grateful for the anxiety, seriously. Anxiety can be a type of gift. It's a difficult gift. It's not a gift that you can decline or give back, but it's a gift you can accept. And it's a gift you can work with and even become friends with. And the energy of it is incredible. If you can just channel it, if you can just make that turn so that the energy is no longer about the future that you fear, so that the energy is about what is here right now. You can make that turn. You ask yourself, but what about now? What about now? What's going on right now? Well, what is it? Well, maybe it's a racing heart. Maybe it's fast breathing. Maybe it's a physical feeling in your stomach. Well, be with that. Don't be with your head. Don't be in your head. Be with what's here right now. There's a way of using it and embracing it and transforming it. You go inside and you come to know this thing, you know. And maybe it's not easy, and maybe it's slow at first, and maybe this year you go about 2 millimeters. But 2 authentic millimeters in your body is better than a year in your head. And maybe next year you go 3 millimeters. Another way to look at that is this is a hero's journey. This is a perilous hero's journey. There are a million stories about this journey. It's a journey that you have to take alone, you know. But you can come to Zen Center, and we're here to send you off, and we're here to welcome you back. And you can bring something back to help us all. And when you do that, when you come back from that journey, you will feel that there is nothing you cannot do. You can deal with any situations. You can have arms as wide as the universe. So please, please do this practice. So thank you.
Thank you.
I would welcome any comments or any questions. Yes, Susan.
Hi, Ted. Thank you for your talk. I wanted to say that I was just reading something this morning. Your talk exemplifies 3 kinds of giving: with gifts, material, dharma, and non-fear. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. 3 kinds of gifts. They were what?
Material.
Dharma and non-fear.
The best is non-fear.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. And was there someone else? Yes.
Oh, I just want to thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. I'm so happy to be able to share this. I've been thinking about it for years. Yes. Was there?
Yeah. This is kind of a question that's maybe a little bit specific about the fear of public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that sitting helps you kind of treat your audience like they're not others? And does that make it easier to do public speaking?
Yeah, I think so. She asked, does sitting help you to see your audience as not other, and does that help with public speaking? I think it does, and it's hard to say just how that is, but sitting eliminates the barrier between self and everything else. And yeah, I mean, do you have anything to add?
Well, it just feels like when you have fear of interacting with other people, and you no longer fear for yourself, you also eliminate that barrier between yourself and other, and then it seems like relations become easier.
Right.
Sitting is part of that process.
It is. It is. And I think, you know, a lot of the difficulty is you're kind of making up stories about your audience. You have this idea of what they expect and what they're going to think about you, you know, and you might even sort of tailor your remarks to what you think they want. And if you can be really authentic and just speak from your heart and not really think about how people are going to receive it, that really goes a lot better. And also, I think another thing that happens with sitting is your heart really opens. And if your heart is really open to your audience, you're less likely to think of them as these really judgmental folks who are like watching for you to mess up so they can laugh at you, which they are not, you know. And you think of them as people who want you to do well, you know, and they're in this with you. Yeah. So that is a really good comment. Thanks. Yes?
What was uppermost for me was when you talked about that moment on the hill and you took the self out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of a novice to this, and I intellectually understand what I think that means, but could you just speak to what the experience was like?
That's really hard to talk about. It's hard to describe. Sometimes that experience has physical manifestations, and it has to do with energy moving up my spine, and it's something happens in the nervous system. I think it's a chemical change that happens. I think now that particular night on the hill, I don't remember that so much, and I can't remember the actual experience that night exactly how it manifested itself. I can certainly remember the results, but this is all this stuff leaves your mind, you know, just this tremendous it's like the 10,000 things are there and they're screaming and then they're kind of gone, and I don't know, I think it probably takes different forms for different people. It happens in very different ways. For some people this is very gradual and very quiet. And for some people, it's really dramatic. And the thing is, you can't know what it's going to be. You know, by definition, you cannot know what's coming. You can only do the practice and open your heart and quiet the mind and see what comes in. Yes, Benton.
I know what you mean about feeling welcome and appreciated at the Zen Center. I felt that here with everybody. I've been able to let my eccentricities out there, and people like me for it.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't it great?
Yeah, it's great.
Isn't it great to just really be yourself?
Yeah, I think that's because everybody here has their own eccentricities, and I appreciate them there.
Yeah, right.
And we just...
Yeah.
Yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very nice. All right. Anything else? Yes, Raymond.
First, I wanted to thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Because opening up a story like that is placing yourself very vulnerable, and in doing that, trusting all of us. And I think that probably a lot of us start with something like that. Second, I wanted to say that your talk today was more than adequate.
Yes!
Okay, not so much. having a similar experience, but perhaps a different take on it. I think sometimes we have moments like that, and all of a sudden we realize, wait a minute, I know this story. I know where it goes. I've been down this path many times.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gives you like a second to think and have a choice. Do I want to go down this fear path that I know, I exactly know where it's going to end up? Or can I do something different?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. You come to know that. You see it again and again. And part of that is wisdom that comes with age. But part of that is sitting on the cushion. Because I really believe that when you're sitting a lot, you begin to see these things at the moment they arise. And that's what's important. You don't notice these things when you're sort of immersed in it. You notice it at that very moment. You learn about the five skandhas, and you find yourself hanging out in the first and second skandhas rather than the fourth and fifth skanda. This is a subject for another talk. But you see it just when it arises, and you see that you have that choice. And that is really, really important work. Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else? Okay. One.